Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric 13, my life is crumbling to pieces, and here with me is Michael Kester. How you doing,
yeah,
Michael?
Yeah, I met Christoph Waltz, so my life is on a steady upward trajectory.
Where did you meet him?
On South Congress in Austin, Texas.
Oh, just on the street, you mean you just...
No, he was in a hat shop.
Oh, okay. All right, well, that makes more sense then. Usually when you tell me you have met someone, I saw them buying a cigar.
I saw them buying a cigar. Yeah, I met them at a cigar shop is my normal.
I just imagine you sit with a cup of coffee outside a cigar shop hat store, like on left and right and just stare and wait for people to show up. Today, we are going to talk about two films as we usually do.
Okay.
We are going to spoil the films.
Okay.
So you can skip halfway, let's say about halfway, almost exactly halfway. To the 24-minute mark where we are going to... What are we covering at 24 minutes?
At 24 minutes, we're going to be covering Trash Humpers. So we're going to start with a film called Henry Fool, which is the first in a trilogy. We didn't watch the other two movies because John didn't ask us to. John asked us to watch Henry Fool.
I like how smooth you... Just completely unfazed by the fact we're talking about Trash Humpers.
Right.
You say it like it's just a movie title.
I mean,
it's vanilla... paint to you.
Trash Humpers. Here's what I'll say before we get to the 24 minute mark about Trash Humpers. Watch it. I'm dead serious. So a lot of people go in, they go, oh, Trash Humpers, that sounds like typical double feature nonsense garbage. Watch this movie, okay?
There's no garbage on double feature. We only cover the best features.
This movie is so much better than you are prepared to give it credit for. That's how I feel about Trash Humpers.
Are you talking to people who have already seen it or people who are going to see it now?
I mean, I'm talking specifically to people who are at this point in tonight's show going, fuck Trash Humpers. That's weird.
Right.
Those people, you are wrong. If you thought going into fuck Trash Humpers, you're right. It's super weird.
Right.
But not fuck Trash Humpers.
I love when I'm watching a movie like this. I haven't seen Trash Humpers before, and we'll get to it later. But while we're on the topic, I see it and I go, fucking genius. And then I go, Michael also thinks this is genius. What are the odds it's for the same reasons?
Right.
and I don't know. We will find out. It's half the fun of this little midnight bookcast we do here. Our underground transgressive book club for movies. I feel like there's another thing, but I sort of always feel like something's missing. You know what I mean?
Right.
Do you get that general sense in life?
Feature. Yeah. Yeah.
No, not
a third feature.
No, I don't think that's quite it. I don't think that's it. Oh, Citizen Kane and The Godfather. People already know that.
Yeah.
If you're listening to Double Feature for the first time, don't listen to this episode. And if you are like, oh, Double Feature, I should check that out. I'll watch Trash Humpers. I think you might have a weird idea of an accurate one, but a weird idea of what this show is. So let's talk about Henry Fool first.
All right. Henry Fool is a movie about the poop that took a pee.
Is that a South Park reference?
You're familiar. I know you're familiar.
Of course.
But
of course.
I feel like Henry, I feel like this may be, I feel like that South Park episode may have drawn quite a bit from Henry Fool.
You have to know that South Park has been on 15 years?
20. Good try, 13, but 20. 15, yeah.
20. South Park has not been on. The Simpsons has been on 20 years.
So yeah, you're right.
If only I was subscribed in iTunes, I could do a quick check here.
So what, 13?
Oh my God, it starts at season one. I have to scroll all the way down.
10?
It is 10. Currently on.
It's 10.
Oh my God, is this real? No, this can't be real. It is on season 20.
That's what I thought.
I just got a sudden pang of nausea. I don't know what to do with myself right now. Okay, let's put this away. Anyways, the inevitability of human demise. Henry Fool is, if you're going to talk about it through metaphor or through a comparison, you have to assume that somebody else has seen a random episode out of 20 years of South Park.
Mm-hmm.
let's assume they haven't. Mm-hmm. Do you want to give you a lowdown on what you're thinking?
I mean, the breakdown is really the same as the plot of this film. It's this, it's the idea that there's a first time writer who creates something so filthy and disgusting and obscene that essentially America vomits over it,
mm-hmm.
metaphorically in this case, literally in South Park. And the best part is that the actual piece, the writing itself, is a total MacGuffin. You never get any part of it. You can't, you know, and the descriptions, the little tidbits, people's reactions all combined mm-hmm. make it really hard to fathom, you know, how can something be both scatological and poetic and meaningful to the human experience?
I submit to trash humpers, but whatever.
Right. No, totally. And I think that I just feel like that episode of South Park probably drew a lot from this, which, so one of the things about this movie that I didn't realize is how much of kind of a cult following it has.
Oh, really?
It has, I mean, the fact that
I didn't think it would have three. So right away I went, this is a whole thing. Isn't one of them have like Jeff Goldblum works for the CIA or something?
I think the second one is like a CIA. They use the same characters, but they switch genres a little bit.
That's really fucking funny. This does not seem like a movie where you're going, oh my God, I can't wait for the sequel to this.
Right. Well,
so that is hilarious to me.
Yeah. And especially because it doesn't actually focus on the same characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this movie kind of, it's called Henry Fool, but I feel like it's less about Henry than maybe some of the other, you know, the writing, the character with the writing, whose name escapes me and I feel terrible. And then the second one is about Henry's wife, and the third is about Henry's son, I believe.
Ned Rifle, I think.
Ned Rifle, there you go.
I have no idea what that even could be about.
So this movie really, I want to say it's heavy-handed, but it's not. It's very subtle. Henry is very heavy-handed, but I think the character is intentionally written in an almost comically heavy-handed way.
Yeah. He has this high school goth kid overwhelming sense of I'm cool.
Yeah.
I was going to say, once again, a South Park character, really. It's mm-hmm. like the kid with the little red swoop or whatever in his hair from mm-hmm. South Park.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of almost like the Buffy TV show for some reason, that kind of sensibility of, I don't know, just enough cheek to make it kind of, that it sort of knows it's doing it, but it's also doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of going... It's kind of laughing at itself, but at the same time, it's using that as a cover to also do the thing that it's laughing at.
Right. No, it.
So by, I can hear you say it's heavy-handed and also not at all.
Right. By being super self-aware, it allows for the ideas to be brought up incredibly ham-handed.
Yeah.
It's just you're being beaten over the head with literal verbiage of philosophical ideas.
I would say it's a fistful of ham behind your back.
Okay.
That's cool. The metaphor I want to use there.
So you have this character who calls out all the things that another more overtly subtle, this is the terminology to describe this.
I know
is
it's
insane,
but I know exactly if you've seen Henry Fool as you should, then you're right on so far.
Yeah. A more overtly subtle movie would definitely be bringing up these themes visually through the story, through the plot, whatever. But this movie kind of tells this subtle story. And then Henry comes in and, points at it over coffee at IHOP and goes, everything's just a fad. Oh, let me guess. This is just kids just like totally. To be here today.
Yeah.
And me
at
and
IHOP
that way,
drinking coffee. Yeah.
Right. And that way you don't have to, there's no mistaking what the movie wants you to take away from it. And then I think that makes the final moments of the movie way more meaningful because it takes a two-dimensional, because he's not a line. It takes a one-dimensional character and actually gives him depth that I didn't expect. I almost expected Henry to be imaginary. That's how...
For half the movie, I assumed that Henry had lived for centuries and appeared, that there was some kind of unspoken supernatural element to it, some sort of like vampiric element to it.
That Henry is kind of the arbiter of great writing. You know, he used to visit William Shakespeare and then went on to visit Cormac McCarthy.
Well, he's got this incredibly long confession. And he talks about, you know, all this stuff that's happened in his past. He makes it sound like, it sounds like Lestat, you know what I mean?
Sure, sure.
So he has this arc, which, by the way, is one-dimensional, I suppose, because that can be a line going from one thing to another, right?
Yes.
Or one-dimensional would kind of just be a dot, though.
One-dimensional is a dot.
Oh, my gosh.
No, zero dimensions is a dot.
Someone please draw us a picture of a dot and then write on it how many dimensions you think it is.
Zero.
We're going to have a competition here. This is a little
draw us a picture with as many dimensions as you can and then tweet it at Pling Michael. I want to see whoever tweets me a picture with the most dimensions wins.
Someone once tried,
I'll record your voicemail message.
Nobody uses voicemail. I swear I'm going to get off this in a second. But someone at some point tried to explain the 10th dimension to me, and I followed them up to about dimension 8. And I could literally conceive it in my mind. It was actually there and I was getting it. And by 9 or 10, it just fell apart. I just couldn't, it didn't make sense anymore.
Uh-huh.
But just look up these explanations, because I'm not going to do it very well. But it has to do with kind of folding things in repeatedly on itself.
Okay.
Bending... it doesn't matter. I'm not even going to try. I'm going to use the self-discipline after this long to not try and explain advanced theoretical dimensionality on our show.
Well, I think that that Henry as a character, he comes into the movie as this almost unreal individual, you know, like we were saying, almost a comical version of a human being, but he still has this very real humanistic impact on everyone.
Mm-hmm.
It's like if you took a cartoon and then brought the cartoon, you know, it's Roger Rabbit, right? It's this character who's a parody of an individual, but I mean, he still, you know, drives a car. He's still got to eat dinner. When he goes through a room, the room is different than it was. Mm. And I feel like it's not until the very, 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 very end of the movie, I mean, the last 3 seconds of the film, that Henry realizes that he's a human being. He's an individual.
Yeah.
He's more than just the sum of his confession.
Well, and I also think where it ends puts him in a spot where he is, he's kind
coming
of
back
put
for
on
sequels.
A, yeah, definitely. Definitely see that. The guy, I mean, it's a titular film. It's a, the movie's called Henry Fool. He has this impact on these other characters. He is put on a sort of pedestal as not necessarily a role model, but I guess someone to guide and
a mentor. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And then to acknowledge that those people are also human is a perspective we often forget. And to see that a person, perhaps even accidentally, becomes a savant poet, and then the very person leading him goes home and goes, "No one will publish my work,
right?
My great work."
Well, and the pangs of reality that keep hitting the two parts of this movie that ground it in the depressing artistic reality that is real life. One is when the publishing company says, "We're not publishing your book. I've published many books. I've published the greatest books. I publish books all the time. I have nothing but the most respect for books. And this is trash." And then
nasty, nasty book.
And then he comes back and goes, "Well, I mean, I didn't realize it was going to make me money." Of course I'm going to publish it. It's going to make, I mean, listen, I believe in you up to the point where we're now talking six figures of return. I didn't believe in you when there was a possibility of negligible return, but now that I have a guaranteed financial gain, I believe you all the way to the bank.
Well, you never know when you make something. This is one of the things that inspires me the most, although it's really embarrassing to say that. It tells you how much credibility I give myself. But you just got to make stuff and put it out. You never fucking know what people are going to, suddenly it speaks to them. Or there is the fact that some artists speak to a lot of people means they're probably making good art. And I do think there is a difference between good art and not as good art.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, you and I are both very adverse to ratings, but I think we can look at two things trying to do something and see if one does it better, but it's really fucking hard.
Mm-hmm. It becomes subjective too, which is the worst thing about art.
Right?
That's the worst part of art. It's also the best part.
It is. Yep. So, you know, the thing that he writes, I mean, that's one of the great questions, as it being intentionally but just left to the side, is
then
we don't know as people, as
so
the audience.
Here's the interesting,
good or not.
This is the interesting thought experiment about that though. Do you for even a second doubt that it's great?
I know exactly what it is because Trash Humper's on the show. I mean, I just assume that it is some, you know, anybody, any synonym name I use here is just going to be a stand-in for Harmony Korine. So let's just say some Harmony Korine.
Yeah.
I don't know fucking John Waters. I mean, you
sure,
know.
Sure, yeah.
Somebody who rolls around in the dirt a little bit.
I mean, yeah, to me though, like, I look at this movie, I hear what people are saying about it, and every time somebody says it's scatological, it's obscene, it, you know, this is pornography, I'm just sitting there going, oh man, this must be really good.
Yeah, well,
I tend to lean toward, if something is just horrible, if it is critically panned on every regard. Here's a great example. The Ghostbusters reboot. When everybody hates something, I feel
you're interested.
Well, it's not that I'm just interested. I feel like
this has touched so many lives. There must be something to it.
We live in an artistically lukewarm pool. Okay. That's how I feel. I feel like the average piece of art is met with meh.
Right.
On average. Right.
Sure.
So I feel like looking at this bell curve, if something is universally loved, it's, you know, the Lego movie, and there has to be something to be said for it. It's doing something so right that everybody is drawn to it.
Yeah.
And if something is universally panned, there has to be something very special, you know, something at least, maybe not necessarily artistically worthy Fantastic Four, but something notable, you know, something double feature notable. This movie is doing something so specific that it's pissing everybody off. It's managed to capture whatever the opposite of lightning in a bottle is. That's what it's doing.
Sure.
It somehow managed to make something so upsetting that we all unanimously go, well, I don't know why, but that is horrible. And so when I'm just interested and I see it and I saw the Ghostbusters movie and I'm sitting there with zero expectations in the lukewarm pool.
Uh-huh.
And I go, oh, special effects are kind of amazing. And, you know, I'm not offended by anything racially or this. Because my expectations are so, I don't want to say low, but there's no raise at all. I'm sitting there going, oh, this wasn't so bad. I think this is something worth watching. This is something that might end up on double feature.
Well, I was going to say there was probably a whole conversation just in the crazy random backlash of one film that doesn't seem particularly backlash.
Exactly.
And compared to other movies.
And so my point is that the more universal negativity directed at the book in this film, the more I am 100% sure it has greatness in it.
Yeah.
And so I'm already on, I'm on the side of the art. So when people go, I can't guarantee that this, I can't publish garbage. I feel like if we were to see the monster and be able to judge the monster before it's walked into a publishing office, there may be some split in the audience over, well, yeah, don't publish it because it's stupid. It's garbage.
Yeah, right, but right.
By making it this glowing briefcase that we are just given these clues that to me win me over on it, I'm angry that somebody's not letting me read it.
Well, and to that point, I think that, you know, literature, for as much kind of grief as we give it on the show because of, you know, the book's better than the movie, because people say that, I feel the need to, even at the beginning of this show, poke fun at literature. But
although I would say the Trash Humpers book far better than the Trash Humpers movie.
When controversial, taboo, opposition crushing, powerful, dangerous ideas come out, they come out on the page first. And they stay buried in books because there's so many books, and people aren't outraged like when they see it in a film, because films are more pop culture, more people go to see them. So, you know, you and I have not scratched the surface of the dredges of humanity as it is written on the page in a shelf somewhere. But this movie also talks about the democratization of art. And actually, I don't even know if it realizes it's doing it, but when they walk into that agency office, I don't know if this is supposed to be a joke, but they talk about how, you know, books are going to be gone. We'll all be reading them on, I don't know, Kindles or something. And you won't even have a TV. You'll have a PC that you watch movies on.
Sure.
And they do it with this sort of elbow and laugh.
Right.
And I'm thinking, what is this, 97? Right. Do they know? Or
well,
is this the funniest thing ever?
It goes back to that thing I was saying about futurism, where you only either mock it or don't talk about it. It's either terrible or hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I think people on the internet love that quote, by the way. I don't know if you've noticed that, but people have run with that. That was what show was that?
Oh, shit. Was it Alphaville?
I don't know if that was.
No.
Maybe Alphaville. I don't know. I have no idea, but someone
Decipher
go find
Sci-Fi
it.
Decipher Sci-Fi knows. I don't know. They're better at our show than I am.
Yes, agreed. I meant me too. Sorry, yeah. I didn't mean to. So the point I was getting at with the massive shelf of books, the massive tome that is out there, and then also the democratization, is that the internet has quickly turned into that conundrum for us in literature. We can see where literature is now and predict where we're moving in a place where there is so much of it. It used to be, if you can get something filmed and put it on the internet, you have made a notable thing. That is, all of a sudden, it is a landmark in a cultural timeline. And then eventually YouTube, and eventually video platforms. And now, I mean, there's trillions of movies you'll never even, that cost millions of dollars to make, and you'll just never even see them. And actually, I think maybe that goes in reverse for literature, because now that it's on the internet, things are more searchable.
Mm-hmm.
But we do sort of, you know, at the same time that we're rallying and make the art and just put it out and we'll see what happens, we're also in a sea of art. And it's a really interesting thing, seeing what rises to the surface and why, and thinking, you know, it's kind of one of the few things where I really evangelize our show, just digging around and finding stuff, and especially our audience, to give them credit.
Mm-hmm.
Finding stuff that even we wouldn't have found.
Like this. I think this is a great example of something we would have never found.
And they're sequels, right? So a whole community of people knows about this.
So what you're saying is, thanks, John, for killing the Henry Fool Killapalooza. Is that what you're...
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying. And, you know, so this comes out during an era where the things that are controversial are video game censorship and the V-chip and... The internet instantly came along and just crushed all that. It became an overwhelming thing that younger people understood, where the most heinous things could be found at the click of a button. And it was a huge brush aside for censorship, but at the same time, it allowed art to get more dangerous and more widespread. And I don't know what the effect of that is either.
I do. I have a pretty strong idea of the effect of that. Yeah, it's called trash humpers. When art gets dangerous and widespread, that's where Harmony Korine came in.
I want to ask you a question about that exact point.
Okay, I have an answer.
Before we go anywhere.
I have an answer.
Because do you think this is more an underground movie or a, like you were saying with Henry Fool, a cult movie?
Man, it's definitely notorious.
I don't know. That's what I was saying.
It is a notorious film.
Right.
But I think it lives way more in Cannibal Holocaust territory, which I would call underground versus whenever you say cult movie, whenever anybody says cult movie, I think of Clue and Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Well, I think of Rocky Horror. I'm not sure there's as many.
You know, I think of things that
Repo and Repo Man.
I think of things that aren't contextually subversive. Their existence is subversive to art, but the actual context of the film isn't necessarily subversive. The Breakfast Club, right?
Yeah. Okay.
It's making a PG point. It's not, you know, trying to upend your belief. I just can't believe I wouldn't call any Harmony Korine anything less than underground.
Well, kids.
Exactly.
But actually, kids has the same thing where a lot of people talk about it without, it has a reputation.
Mm-hmm.
A Serbian film has a reputation.
Right.
You know, there are things that you hear about traveling in certain circles.
Think of it this way. This is going to become my new barometer for cult films.
Mm.
If you screened it at midnight, would it sell out?
Oh, that's an interesting one.
And I think the answer is no. I think that the answer is no for Trash Humpers.
You know what this is? It is the Music Box versus, I've fucking forgotten the name of that other theater that I used to go to.
The
Cine Family one.
Right. Yeah. I don't remember the name either.
Fuck.
Apparently it doesn't have as much notoriety.
Right. Facets, what I was thinking of. Right. So Facets would almost, I never went to a sold out show there, but every film there was notorious and I'd never heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it is this, I think of it as a kind of underground, you know, the walk between Rocky Horror Picture Show and Cannibal Holocaust is such a good one. I think it's hard for us because Cannibal Holocaust is like a date movie.
Right.
So I don't even know.
Speaking of barometers, if I go on a date and it's to Cannibal Holocaust and we don't make it through the movie comfortably, then that's the last date. That's how that goes.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know if we're very good judges of this, but I'd probably, you know, there is, these can overlap. Certainly it can be cult, but also pretty underground. But I think for the most part, it does have to, you can fall in the center-ish.
Mm-hmm.
But most things I feel like are going to swing one way or another.
I agree. Yep.
And, you know, the movies that are transgressive underground are every time going to be head scratchers or things that you can't believe you're seeing.
Right.
Yeah. Or trash humpers, head scratchers,
yeah.
You know, these types of movies. These are the secret handshakes of film.
Yeah.
These are the things that people can... Here, let me give you another way that I think maybe we can label this. Five people can stand in a circle and talk about this film at some sort of film event, even if none of them have seen it. I think those are the kind of underground movies
where they've
all heard a legend of trash humpers and they can all kind of talk about, isn't that crazy? And I heard at Cannes this happened, blah, blah, blah. And nobody even would know what's in it.
Right.
They would just know, have you heard of this thing called Trash Humpers?
Well, and to kind of continue with that thought experiment, one of the things that I love about Trash Humpers is, one, as I said at the beginning of the show, I think it's important. I think everybody should see it. I think it makes incredibly strong points and it's something that everybody needs to see. But one of my favorite things about Trash Humpers is when I'm in a group of people and I go, have you seen Trash Humpers? Anybody who says yes or rather anybody who's heard of it but not seen it, will be, you know, what's that about? And I go, oh, well, I mean, it's about people who hump trash. They go, yeah, but like, what else happens? And you kind of go, I mean, they hump a lot of trash. It's a movie that its reputation of being, isn't that a movie where like people hump trash? The answer is just yes. And then the follow-up phrase for me is always, but it's awesome. You have to see it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, there's a lot of things that as an experiment or as a, I would say more an exercise than an experiment. Mm-hmm. I don't really even think I'd call this an experimental film. I think. Yeah?
Yeah, a little.
Do you think Corinne is setting out to, here, instead of giving you a loaded question, I'll give you why I think that. I don't feel like he's going, let's just film a bunch of stuff and assemble it to test if this works or if that works or what impact these things have. I feel like Corinne goes out, whether he's correct or not, with some idea in his head of what he's about to bestow upon an audience.
Yeah, see, I feel like this is maybe more Inland Empire. I feel like Harmony Korine goes, all right, so we've got these old people costumes. I'm going to turn on the camera. Let's just walk around.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, welcome to Double Feature, show hypothesizing what's in Harmony Korine's needlessly speculating about what Harmony Korine is thinking while making movies.
And I think that the point that the movie makes is, For a film with so little tangible
substance. You don't need
substance,
a word after that. You could just say, yeah,
people yeah, know. No, you're right. For a film with so little, I feel like the point is so strong. Mm. I feel like you have this movie. It's about these old people who essentially have just divorced themselves from society, and it is irreconcilable differences, this divorce. And I feel like the whole movie is summed up in one scene, in one line. And I
also kind of feel that way. I'm really excited to see
where they're driving in the car at night and they're looking at the houses. And he says, I wish I could remember it verbatim, but he says, look at all these people in their stupid little houses, going to their stupid little jobs.
I think it's, you can smell how they're trapped in their lives or something like that.
Yeah. And that, I feel like as soon as that line happens, and I'm so glad that it's not early in the film, it's so much later, it immediately opens up everything you've seen and you go, ah, oh, shit. They're kind of just doing whatever they want, aren't they? Mm-hmm. There is an easy rider type freedom to these three characters. It just so happens that they're garbage.
Well, it's interesting to me. We picked the exact same line, and I think that's the movie. That's thumbs up to the movie as far as knowing it's delivering a point there.
Right.
The other question that Henry Fool invokes and comes into Trash Humpers is the idea of art being twofold, being the mind and the hand, mm-hmm. the ideas a person has and the craft, the not necessarily amount of skill, but, you know, I've used this before on the show, but two people can talk for days about music and jamming and they're going to write these songs and they totally hit it off. And then, you know, you show up to the person's house to play and they're just terrible.
Right.
And you realize they're thinking on another level, but this wasn't what I thought it was at all.
Right. Totally.
And so you make the measure of those things, but in the experience or experiment mm-hmm. of, depending on which Harmony Korine you are, the mind or the hand, perhaps, in seeing this, I think a movie that does, what was the phrase? Just does so little, was that it?
Yeah, does so little, yeah.
I thought it was like a two word. I feel like even our tagline, does so little, is is too long for the movie. Humps trash is probably,
right. Yeah.
Or the trash humpers, they hump trash. Uh-huh. That's the, okay. You're forced to sit there and think, why? Mm-hmm. You cannot see this movie the entire way through without coming out with at least, I don't want to say you have to have an idea, because I do think it's very perplexing, but questions, a whole lot of questions and a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is right away, you know, you're asking questions about what is a movie, what passes for a movie, what are the elements, why do, you know, did this affect me? Was it, you know, what parts were they telling me, what things? You think about all these different little elements of art. And then I also think, you know, we're testing, the part of it that feels transgressive is that we are testing this perception. Same thing with literature and Henry Fool. We're testing perceptions of taste, of societal boundaries, you know, of law, religion. I mean, these are the tenets of mm-hmm. transgression. And I usually address them as poking at society. Filmmakers right, sure. that poke yeah. at society.
Poking the social bear.
But, you know, transgressive movies, you can, I mean, literally defend any of them the same way. Mm-hmm. They all have, at the very least, the idea that people think one way and we're gonna swing out the other way and judge people's reactions.
Right.
If people come out and say that, I mean, I would argue that transgressive literature and art in general is sort of the inverted space. It's sort of taking a piece of paper and only drawing the black negative space to create the image.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a taboo in society, or you have a law or a social norm, you can stand up and try and explain why this thing is not okay. And then somebody else, to make a counterpoint or even to validate what you're saying, can do the thing. So instead of everybody standing around going, this isn't okay, somebody could do it and show it to you. And then we kind of see, well, if it is done, what does it look like? And is it as bad as we think? And why is that thing so bad? I mean, any kind of masturbation, right? Mm-hmm. As a
sure,
taboo.
Sure.
And talking about it in society seems like, whoa, huge taboo. We can't go doing that. But if you were to discuss masturbation openly, society would not crumble.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make a piece of transgressive art and put it out there, and you'll notice, oh, society doesn't fold when we're talking right, about this idea. Right. In fact, nothing changes except people can express themselves. And, you know, that is just a ultimate kind of argument and why I love these films so much.
Yeah. I feel like in the realm of Harmony Korine, have we done them all now? Yeah, we've done them all. This is the last one.
Umshimi, man.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I don't know. There's a lot of Korean shorts.
It's a short film. We can't do those. Those are a lot. The format for double feature does not allow for all the wonderful short films I want to cover. That's just a sad thing.
It does allow for triple features where we don't do one of the movies.
Right.
That's one of the core tenets here.
Yeah. I feel like within Harmony Korine's filmography, so if I miss any, you know, correct me, but there's Julian Donkey Boy, Gummo,
Ooh,
Mr.
Julian
Lonely.
Donkey Boy, though, don't forget, that is you know what? I was thinking of The Idiots.
Right.
For obvious reasons,
Julian,
but that's
Donkey
Lars
Boy.
Von Trier. Julian right. Donkey Boy is Harmony Korine. Yeah.
Julian
wow,
Donkey
I forgot
Boy,
that Lars
Mr.
Von Trier
Lonely.
Made The Idiots. That's weird.
Gummo, Spring Breakers, and Trash Humpers, right? Those are the Harmony Korine features.
So. Yeah, I'm
missing
think
so. I feel here's my postulation to you. I feel like Trash Humpers is the hardest, the most challenging film of all of his movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it is the most positive and celebratory of all of his movies.
Yeah, I mean, it does have a certain, when we were talking about Bad Grandpa
mm-hmm.
and Jackass especially, it has a precursor to Jackass type mentality that mm-hmm. is really celebratory. Well, I totally feel that.
And I feel like, unlike Harmony Korine's standard protagonists, none of these people are questioning themselves or their roles or their place in society. There is right. no underlying depression to any of this movie. this movie is the confidence with which the only characters were given go about their day makes it really hard to, compared to something like Gummo, or just for the sake of today's show, compared to something like Henry Fool, there is no trepidation. When the audience is watching this movie, there's no trepidation as to, should I feel bad about this?
Yeah, right.
Am I seeing something that I ignore in my daily life? Right. Kind of, looking the other way when you pass a homeless man on the street,
sure.
That feeling where you're technically not doing anything wrong, but you're also not doing anything right.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, this movie feels like one of the only Harmony Korine movies where you're not voyeuristically examining somebody who's worse off than you.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Even if that, you know, whether that's to criticize or to hold up.
Mm-hmm.
And we see a mixture of that. I mean, it's so stupid. I do this all the time. So brought up this idea of negative space and of transgressive cinema. I have not applied it to this movie at all. So, hey, here in Double Feature, we just saw Trash Humpers. So we're looking at a movie that, in a more broad sense, is celebrating carnality, is celebrating impulse, and just doing the not affected by society. We don't see people really look on and be shocked, and you know, that doesn't exist. It's these people blissfully living what we would look at as, you know, these kind of stupid lives. But they, again, in performing that exercise, in going, well, what if you lived by a gross base impulse that, you know, produces nothing and is totally meaningless? You find out things. You find out that they haven't changed the world, but they seem happy all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they see everything seems funny.
Well, they
wonderful.
Seem happy unless they see dogs or plastic bags. That's when seem unhappy.
Right. Yeah. I don't know what that says, but sure, throw that in there too. You have another line being pushed. This is just a great ante upper all the time. But when they bring a younger child into it,
mm-hmm.
and that's when I think is. An audience, a lot of people will, it takes them back into reality. They're going, these are a bunch of adults playing pretend. Okay, they can do whatever dirty thing they want. But when they see someone younger on that stage, they go, well, wait, there was really a person that age hanging out with these delinquents.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a new level of offense. And I think, again, that's the same thing. Transgressive cinema doesn't always have to evangelize the thing. Spring Breakers might be the best example of that. You know, it's more craven, depraved people. I don't think it's holding them up. Some of them, I think it's holding them up. But, you know, it's also, that's what a transgressive cautionary tale might be. And you fold things inward sometimes and go, oh, well, maybe this taboo is for a good reason, or this slice of the taboo, these pieces of it. Maybe people on the beach being stupid is okay, but then giving blowjobs to handguns is dangerous. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get to find these other elements of it. And that can be just as powerful as the highest ideas of a film. If you did all the opposite things of Trash Humpers, I'm not even sure what that would fucking look like. But if you were
Citizen
to...
Citizen Kane, I believe, is the opposite things of
if
Trash Humpers.
You try and uphold all of these... beyond ideas, but maybe ways of life or principles of morality or how the common man should or does live. The highest example of that, I think the negative space is just as important, can be just as profound, even though it looks like Trash Humpers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people walking away from the show would have a hard time convincing their friends that Trash Humpers is as profound as whatever they experience as the opposite.
Right.
But if it's making that counter argument, in some ways, it's showing you the side. Everybody always makes the argument. The negative space argument is something people rarely, oh, well, if you think saying fuck in public is so bad, I just did it. Look, nothing happened. You don't get nearly as much of that. And I think there's a good place for it. The other thing you reminded me of when you were talking about the smell of these people trapped in their lives, their stupid lives and their stupid little cars and jobs, you know what that sounds like? It sounds like these people are asleep. We wake them up.
Right.
Doesn't it?
Totally. Totally.
I mean, it's got a lot of that too. And I think Corinne takes a lot of pride in that. I feel like he makes these movies and he can't wait to chuck them out there and then see what happens. Mm-hmm. If there's anything that I would say is experimental about him, I would definitely say he's excited for when he puts the movie out and, you know, he's making Trash Humpers and I'm sure he's going, people are going to see this. What are they going to think? Mm-hmm. And maybe amused by it or may, you know,
I'm not even sure. I'm not even 100% sure Harmony Korine sees the true ridiculousness of something like Trash Humpers.
Profound like Mr. Brainwash.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's Exit Through the Gift Shop is a good place for a lot of those conversations from Warhol to Banksy to Mr. Brainwash. And to other shows we've done, actually. You can get them on doublefeature.fm. That's the website. The email address that is a secret handshake address. I never give this out. So write it down. You ready? Mm-hmm. Hold on. I lost the email address. What's our email address?
Here. You know what? I'll tweet it. I'll tweet the email. I'll find it.
Doublefeature. I actually don't know what it is. It's doublefeatureshow@icloud.com.
That's it.
That's the email address.
Whatever.
At ERIC. Nope. Fuck that up again. @_ERIC_X13 is my name and my Twitter handle.
I'm at Playing Michael. And like I said, tweet me your dimensional drawings, your multi-dimensional drawings. Also, while you were speaking, instead of listening to you, I was going back through our schedule. They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Was oddly the one where we were talking about futurism. That's what that nonsense was.
That's usually we just talk about it and we both look at each other and nobody's going to go check that schedule.
Right.
That's not going to happen. I'd have to pull up a document. And I'm in a FaceTime window. I can't even, there's nothing that exists outside this space.
Nothing. There are a few things that exist outside this space.
Seth Anasek, Liam Duffy, Christopher Peterson, Jeremy Momenthal, Athena Banks, Tom Comey, Jill Moriarty, Eric Tachek, Charles Crawford. Thank you for teeing that up for me.
You're welcome, Michael Kessler. If you had a hard time with Trash Humpers, we're just going to keep that hard time rolling. Next time we're going to cover Eli Roth's other movie from the same year as Green Inferno. That was Knock Knock. So we're going to cover that. That's another tally for Keanu Reeves, by the way. So I believe Keanu Reeves and Willem Dafoe are nearly tied at this point this year.
Someone's keeping track and it's on Twitter, I assume.
And then we're pairing that with, hey, Lucky McKee. Remember Lucky McKee back from May, one of the movies that made horror actual viable genre? I'm down with that. His movie was called All Cheerleaders Die. And if you watch The Woman, this is in some ways easier and in some ways harder. So
that's definitely true. I think the whole rest of this year, we're plowing through it. It is going to be trickier and trickier cinema. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a lot coming up that strap in, I guess.
No, I believe what you meant to say was watch more fucking film.
That's it. Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.